You're listening to Well Made, a podcast from Lumi about the people and ideas behind your favorite online brands. I'm your host, Stefan Ango. JT Marino, welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
So JT, you are the co-founder of Tuft & Needle and now the chief strategy officer at Serta Simmons. I think people who listen to this will probably be familiar with Tuft & Needle, but how do you describe it these days? And what is it like to now be part of a bigger company?
So Tuft & Needle is the original mattress industry disruptor. We originally started with a single mattress with a free trial, returns that are donated purely online. And our goal was to disrupt the mattress industry, but not just catalyze it, but complete the disruption and change it forever. And really that change was to take leadership and of the industry and turn it to being one that serves customers and serves people first as its first priority, as opposed to retailers or just their EBITDA plans. Yeah, that's really been our goal since the very beginning, which started very small and has had over time ripple effects. And you see a lot of other companies start doing similar things, which we has its pros and cons, but for the most part is really built a massive trend. And then, you know, Serta Simmons Bedding merged with our company, which is a whole story there. Yeah, as far as how that's going, it's a big job. There's a lot to do. So yeah, that's just a quick overview.
And there's so many different things about your story and where Tuft & Needle is today that I'd love to explore. I think, you know, some of the big things that people may not know, you were bootstrapped and were able to grow to hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue without investors. That's like a huge topic that I would love to dive into. You're based in Phoenix, which is really unusual, but although at the same time, we've had some really interesting conversations lately with companies like Porter Road. They're a butcher shop based in Kentucky that is, you know, a direct-to-consumer meat company. We were talking to Floyd, the furniture company based out of Detroit. So we're seeing that pop up a lot lately, as well as kind of the move towards like how can the direct-to-consumer market work without necessarily relying on investors. There's a good intersection of those things happening with you. But I guess kind of zooming back to the beginnings of Tuft & Needle, what inspired you to create it? Why did you start Tuft & Needle?
So it really started with my co-founder and I. We're best friends from college. And we both sort of attached at the hips when we met each other at college. And then later on in our careers into technology in Silicon Valley, had our hands in several startups, helping them build their businesses, for the most part from scratch. But we'd always talked about starting something of our own. And having gone down the path of making, you know, app after app and various software platforms, we wanted a bit of a change, and we also wanted to try to build a business in a different way. So every company we'd been involved with had some sort of funding, and we wanted to build something that could grow on its own. And so when we had decided to do that, we were seriously talking about it near the end of 2011, and then finally made the decision early 2012. We sat down and we listed all the rules of the game. If we were going to start a company, before we come up with the idea, what kind of a company would we want to start? So a couple items on the list. One, we didn't want investors. So we wanted to have full control and to be able to build it our way. Whether that meant we built a little, you know, something small or something more boutique, more lifestyle, or something that could go all the way, it didn't really matter much to us how big it could be. We did want to disrupt something and cause a change that we could be proud of. Rather than just making something for profit and gain, we wanted to do something that we really felt mattered. And we wanted to solve a real problem. So one of the things that we had learned over time was we hear all these big tech startups and these great companies that are really innovative. Behind them are legions of thousands of startups. And many of them are just iterations of the big ones, whichever is hot, or is just a mashup of this and that. Or it's just a great idea that you can pitch to an investor, and you're really just kind of sharing, you know, the value of your equity that can be flipped to the next investor and flipped. And we wanted to start with something that was genuine, authentic, had a had a good solid foundation of a problem to solve. So, and so as we spent I would say about a couple weeks to do a retrospective on our lives, listing out all of the pain points that we've had. At first, the first few days, we couldn't come up with anything, but then we started listening, and then the idea started flowing. So we had a lot of ideas, a lot of pain points that we had each experienced. One of them I had written down was shopping for a mattress, because I had shopped for a mattress and it was the worst shopping experience of my life. It seemed like jumping back in the 80s is a whole nother story. I won't dive into unless you want to. But I went shopping for a mattress, spent $3,500 on it. Had to deal with the salesman and the tricks and the tactics and going between stores and trying to research online but not getting anywhere because it was all misinformation and on. It just felt really outdated. And so we kept going back to that one. It seemed pretty unsexy and really weird, but there's something eccentric about it, and that was that it was not related to software at all, and it was a physical product, and it was a big product. We didn't know anything about it, so we thought it would be a good challenge. So from there, what we did was we thought, okay, so how do we know if this would even work? We don't know anything about the supply chain. We don't know anything about making a mattress or the product. Don't even know about the components, what are these different materials called and all that. So just to kind of ground it, we started, you know, sort of almost like from first engineering first principles, just listing out all the issues. We called this the hate list. We took a legal pad, we wrote at the top the hate list, and we listed out everything we hated about shopping for a mattress and everything we hated about mattresses. An example. So not being able to find facts about the products online, like specs. Like if you're going to shop for a mattress or a computer, memory speed, screen resolution, processor speed, you know, things like that, there is no standardization. So it's difficult to figure out what it is. It's difficult to know if a mattress is good for you if you lay on it for a couple minutes in a store. You really got to sleep on it. Salesman, takes a long time to get it. It's expensive. I mean, just a lot of stuff. And so from that list, what we did was we just drew a line down the center. And what would we do instead if we were to start a mattress company from scratch? So instead of lots of mattress options, what if we started with one? Which the mattress industry would say is impossible. You can't make a mattress that works for everybody, which we've later proven to be true. You definitely can. Another is, what if you didn't have salespeople? What if you didn't bake in all the retail markups and retailers cut into the pricing, and now you can offer a lower price that provides more value to the customer? What if you could ship fast? What if you could do a return so you can have a free trial? So we listed out all the things that we, you know, the antithesis to all these pains, which was maybe the fixes. And then we reduced it down to what are the absolute minimum of these that we felt realistically we could solve on launch. And that if we solved these, then people would maybe try a brand that they've never heard of because we've solved a number of the frustrations that they had. So sort of like our MVP. From there, we built a single page website. It was a total facade. It was just a test. We took a photo stock image of a mattress, and then we converted those fixes into value proposition statements with some imagery and copy. And at the bottom of the page, we had a credit card form that I hooked up, but it wouldn't actually capture the money, but it would send a signal and somebody would click process. So we set the site up. It took about 2 days to build. So we launch it, and I was actually sitting in Coupa Cafe downtown Palo Alto. And it was like 8 o'clock. It was buzzing, and Dehi was elsewhere. And so I sent him a text and said, "Okay, the site's up." And then a couple minutes later, he sent me a text and said, "Okay, the Google ad is up." And I just sort of went back to work. And 15 minutes later, I got a phone call from Dehi. And he's screaming over the phone. I can't understand what he's saying. And I'm like, "Calm down. Like, I can't, what are you saying?" And then he's like, "Dude, we just made a sale." And I like froze. And then I jumped out of my chair almost so fast, a chair flew behind me with my arms in the air. And I yelled, "Jackpot," like really loud. And the whole cafe froze. And they all turned and looked at me. And I was like staring at them with my mouth open, like in shock. And then I noticed that there were people like grinning, like ear to ear, nodding up and down, and they knew exactly what happened. So that was the test passing. The test that we had set up, it passed our We wanted to see if we could get somebody to hand us a dollar for this concept. So,
what was the price point on it at that point?
I believe it was $800. It was more expensive than our product is now.
Wow! And within 15 minutes, how's that even possible?
The pain is so bad. Like, people hate shopping for a mattress. So there's definitely some luck involved here, but we had just the right features listed. We picked the right ones to solve for. And so the value prop was right. And because you think about it, to build a brand, and I knew nothing about brand. Coming from the tech world, brand is not like a thing you hear much about in like a D2C digitally native brand where you're going after an older market that's not just pure software. You know, brand is a thing. It's a big thing. It's an important thing. Now, in hindsight, I realize like how lucky we were, because you have to convince somebody who's never heard of you to buy from you. And in order to do that, your value proposition must be very enticing. And then the ad was just maybe, I don't know, maybe it was just the right time of day and it was just the right kind of copy. But we had somebody click through the ad and then read the site and then type in their credit card information and hit process. And then they got an error. we got a message that said that somebody attempted it. And that's when we were like, holy shit.
But was it called Tuft & Needle at that point?
No, it was just a project. It was a pet project name. It was just kind of a throwaway. But so we shut that site down. That was in June of 2012. Over the summer, that's when we're like, okay, well, we're very excited, but okay, how do you make a mattress? Who makes them? We don't even know if the unit economics would work. So, you know, we just randomly picked the price point. We picked a price based, there was the only, like the logic behind picking the price was, what is the lowest price that we each would pay, but wouldn't be so low that we thought it was junk? So anyway, that's how we determined the price and backed into it.
Wait a minute. Did you ever find out who that person was? You should go shake that person's hand. And say,
I should. I've had a few people mention that. No, I'm kind of, I don't know how they'd respond. I don't know if we have the information recorded somewhere. We might, but
yeah,
I kind of like it being this mystery person who represents the people.
So based on that kind of like test, then you went and did the full blown thing, or you started thinking about the supply chain and the manufacturing behind it?
Well, so this was definitely the first major hurdle. Well, I mean, I would say the test was a hurdle, but this was like a very serious hurdle. Over the summer, we had to figure out how do you make a mattress and who makes them. And I mean, we were navigating the social network from like the white pages and yellow pages because we couldn't find factories online. Now every factory in the mattress industry has a website because they want to they're like wanting to capture the next Tuft & Needle. But back then, I mean, I would call when I would finally figure it out, like who made what. And I would call them and say, you know, we're this new company. We haven't started yet. We're making a mattress. We'd love to see like what you know, options you have as far as fabrics or foams or things like that. Several of them were like not interested and they would hang up on me. And I rented a car and went up and down the East Coast and West Coast. That's really where the factories seemed to congregate. And I literally would just walk into the factory. I'd walk in through like the roll-up door where the trucks would pull up to and find somebody on the factory floor and say, hey, could you introduce me to your salesperson? Now they had to kick me out, which did not happen. So even a couple of the people who hung up on me who forgot who I was would sit down and I would have this conversation again. But we ended up finding a small mom and pop factory in Ontario, California. Actually, it was Buena Park, and they were willing to work with us, and they were also willing to offer no minimum order quantity, which was something that we couldn't find either. And I was able to convince them to give us terms.
How did you negotiate that right out of the gate?
It was just an emotional negotiation, just connecting with the owner of the company. I met him, I talked to him, and we kind of hit it off, told him really what we were trying to do. We want to change this industry, we want to fix it. And he was bought and sold in on it, and he's like, well, how can I help? The first thing was, well, we don't have any funding. If we didn't have minimum order quantity, if you could help us iterate on the first product and ideally give us terms. And he said he'd give us a short amount of terms, and if as we proved ourselves, he would increase it. So So anyway, over the summer was I cut my mattress open, labeled the parts. This is the mattress I bought that I had a terrible experience with. Figured out which factories made which parts, which ones put it together. And then from there, you know, we had to open up a bank account. So Dahi and I, we had about 8 months of savings to pay our bills before we were out and we would have to get a job. We did set up a small little contracting job on the side just in case this all fell through. But when we officially launched Tuft & Needle in October of 2012, we had 4 months to get to profitability, and we did. We actually were profitable within the first few weeks, and then we had to grow it enough that we were able to pay ourselves just enough to get by. So we reduced our cost of living to as scrappy as we could. I only literally ate ramen noodles. And so we had to get to what, you know, and I'm doing air quotes, like what they call ramen profitability. And we kept ourselves at that salary for almost 3 years, even after we had hired almost 15 people before we gave ourselves a little bit more wiggle room, to breathe.
So at that point, are you doing pre-orders, or how did you manage to, because if they're just like your orders are dripping in one at a time, it seems like the manufacturer would still want to get like some sort of production run going.
Well, what they did was they would produce a small batch and they would hold it. And then as we would get orders, we would send them the order, and then they would ship it to the customer. We also figured out how to get the mattress in a box. It was not as small of a box as we have now, but we knew that if we were to ship this on like a truck, it was going to be too expensive for the customers. So we figured out how to get it into a box small enough that FedEx would accept it, which involved a shop vac and on the opposite side, so it would suck air, and a big mattress bag and duct tape, and getting up onto a table and rolling it after we sucked the air out. So now we have all these fully automated machines that do it, which we actually helped design early versions of. We started with $6,000, and so we had just our savings to hold us together. He had his home and his expenses. I had mine, and then we both put $3,000 into an account to open it. And then the other point was, by negotiating that short window of terms with the factory, and by charging the customer up front, you have negative working capital. So we received the money first before we had to pay the factory. Then, and this is not a plug, I promise you, we got an Amex Plum card, which gave us 60 days on top of that. So I also was able to convince them to take a credit card payment.
I think this is an actually super important point around cash flow that most people don't actually understand. I mean, it sounds like it makes sense when you describe it that way, but I don't think people really understand what that actually does for your business. Can you explain it a little bit more?
Sure. So when a customer comes to the website and they put the credit card form in, or fill out the credit card form and make a payment, we then receive that money in 2 days after it processes through the credit card processor. But when we place that order with the factory and they ship it out, they were billing us one at a time. So essentially, we would owe all of the orders from a day 15 days later. So we had the money in the bank, and then we make the payment 15 days later. That's how we are able to afford to pay for the inventory. The typically how it would go is you pre-buy the inventory. So you would buy 100 mattresses, and then you would send the order to the factory, and then they would ship out as they're coming in. But you have to have the capital in order to invest. And now these are expensive products, so they're multiple hundreds of dollars. So if their minimum requirement is 300, which a lot of these factories were, we didn't have the kind of capital to even invest in that, let alone know for sure that we were going to be able to sell through it because we were just getting started. So there was a lot of risks in doing that for us. So we were able to rebalance the risk a bit with this other factory. And it was, like I said, a small mom and pop. Even though they're small, they're very efficient and very successful. And, you know, I guess they got some confidence from Dahi and my background. You know, they at least thought we knew what we were doing and were willing to take a small risk. But they were really just, you know, it's just onesies twosies. So if we messed up, then they weren't really out that much. So
why was it so important to you to not take investors at that point in time?
Well, for a number of reasons. From my experience at other startups, when you receive a lot of capital, you end up doing, the capital is used to accelerate growth. And one of the ways you do that is by staffing up very fast and also by ramping up your marketing really fast. As an engineering background, I like to be very pragmatic and really solve the problems. I've seen how money can mask the true problems that you need to solve. So if we were to have to grow on our own, we would really have to nail the product, nail the service, the pricing. You see, everything has to be right. It's not just, there's no silver bullet. You have to get all of the things right. And theoretically, if you follow this process based on customer feedback, then customers would be delighted and ideally would be sharing and becoming your salesman. They would be sharing it with their friends and their family. So that was part of it. It was more of a methodical point of view, you know, which risks slower growth, but ideally higher quality product and business. Another standpoint was we didn't have an exit strategy. So we weren't thinking, okay, we're going to build this thing up to take it public or build it up to sell it or to, we were thinking, let's just build a really successful business, even if it only did, you know, a small amount of money that could just pay us what our salaries were at the previous job. If that was it, that was fine. But we knew that if that was all it would ever be, then ideally it should be profitable so it can pay us. So we wanted to be able to build the team the way we wanted at the rate we wanted. We didn't want to sacrifice our business just for the sake of growth. I wanted this business to die if it wasn't good. But and it's because of that, it's like by adding these constraints, it forces you to flex your mind and try to figure these problems out. It was really just a different approach. It's like playing the game on hard mode. There were times where we were like, is this really the way we should have done it? Is this going to pay off because we built it this way? What are the benefits? Like we've always sort of self-assessed, like, did we choose the right path here?
Well, also at some point, other folks figured out that selling mattresses on the internet was a good idea. And a lot of those companies did end up raising, you know, hundreds of millions of dollars. That there must have been, you know, some questions, you know, among your team of like, hey, what are we going to do about this? Or how did you keep everyone focused at that point in time?
Oh, sure. So 2012. So then 2013, it was still Dahi and I. Another little trick that we used to stay bootstrapped, stay profitable, keep costs low was we hired our brothers to do customer service. And, you know, my brother worked for free few months over the summer between college. And he's at the company still. So 2013, we did $1 million in sales. Now we're starting to get some buzz. We got our first venture capitalist who was a customer send us an email and say, wait a second, are you guys a startup? And we replied, yeah. And he's like, wow, a mattress company. Okay. And he's like, are you interested in raising capital? And then one thing led to another and we started getting, it was flooding in. 2013, we did $1 million in sales, which isn't much. So you take out our margin, cut that in half and take out taxes and then, you know, a little tiny bit of market. It's not really leaving you much, but still nonetheless, it was $1 million. The next year, 2014, was when we really started to grow. And we got our first big article. Well, actually, we wrote an article on Hacker News saying how we bootstrapped to the number one mattress on Amazon. And it stayed at the top of Hacker News for almost 2 days. And just the right people read that. And one of the journalists at Forbes wrote an article, Meet the Warby Parker of Mattresses. That's when it really blew up. And that's when VCs are like, oh, this is a space we can play in. I literally had two venture capitalists, two different ones, say, if you don't take our money, we'll find somebody who will. We've decided to play in this space. One of those investors ended up funding our very first lookalike that launched in 2014. And yeah, it was definitely scary. You know, this being our first company, that's ours, being bootstrapped, so cash poor for the most part, not having a safety net, and then seeing a competitor start with all this cash who can pay for the best marketing agencies and the best branding agencies and outspend you was definitely scary. But what always grounded us was looking back at our numbers and looking back at what our customers were saying. And as they would release their numbers through the years, we would compare that to ours, and we were neck and neck the whole time. So we saw that we didn't really need to raise capital. Every year, starting in 2014, the team didn't really know this, only a few, but we would go out and we would pitch to VCs just to see if there was an opportunity, if we could get good terms, maybe we'd do it. And it was also really good to get feedback because investors look at your business a very different way. And we would take that feedback back to our business and make improvements. But either way, every time we went through that exercise, we ended up deciding we didn't need it.
That's actually kind of fascinating, though, as a mechanism, even if you're not going to take the money, just to try it. And it tests you in terms of, are you thinking about this right? It puts you through the rigor of actually, you know, having to produce those numbers and, like, you know, organize your financials so that you can present them that way. Was there anything that, like, outcomes from those meetings that you really applied to the business that you can point to?
Oh, yeah. So that's when we started to learn how to build an operating plan and how to manage finances. So when you would go to pitch, we realized very quickly they want to know what your numbers will do. So we had to build out a forecast. And how do you do that? Well, then we had to learn how to do that. Then we got an advisor. And then we hired a part-time CFO. And then later we hired a CFO. And so we learned how to project and forecast an operating plan and figuring out what are the factors that would lead to growth. What things will we do that will be growth driven? What will our costs be? And then how do you present yourself? What are the key values and differentiators of your business? Really tells you, wait a second, we need to keep investing in those things because that's really resonating with investors. Investors, they look at the business a very different way. You can't just take everything they say as truth. It's only like part truth, because there's another side, which is running and operating a business and building it. But they understand the world in a different way, and you can learn a lot from it. And we did. And we used a lot of those learnings. And I'm still friends with a lot of the investors that we talked to. We did this exercise to see if we could raise capital and to see if we could use it. But every time we'd done this four times, it just sort of ended up in a even with good terms, we just couldn't figure out how we would use the money. Because we were growing fast enough. So yeah, that's from that perspective was really helpful for us.
Do you think there's too much venture capital going into the direct-to-consumer market? Or do you think that founders who are in this area of like digitally native brands are taking the easy mode too often?
I don't think there's too much going into direct-to-consumer, but I think that the terms and the valuations are. Because you can't value a D2C brand the way you do a tech company, the multiples, you can't measure it the same way. This isn't like a multi-trillion-dollar industry like the tech industry. This is like the mattress industry is $17 billion. You're going to hit the law of big numbers much faster. It gets much harder to grow. Once you hit $100 million, you start to feel it. You hit $300 million, you really start to feel it. About 25% of all sales for mattresses now are done online. Still, it's not really that much. So if you really want to grow beyond online, once online's been captured by, you know, the top 3 to 5, which it has been already, it gets hard. So if you want to keep growing, you have to move offline. And that takes a lot of time. Like we partner with Walmart to scale out in Walmart, or we partner with Lowe's to scale out in Lowe's, or if you're going to open up your own retail stores, long time. So it just doesn't make that much sense to me, because if you think about what kind of a return you need if you were to sell the business, you know, to the public market or be acquired, or in our case, we did a merger, which is really unique. The kind of return you would need would be astronomical and unaffordable. So at least if you're going to be acquired or merged. So I don't think it makes sense to value the companies like this. I also think that investors in the D2C market don't realize how quickly these companies sort of cap out and slow down and their growth slows. And then how much time it takes to really scale beyond that. You can build a multi-billion dollar business, you know, in some markets, but it's not going to be overnight that happens.
Do you think that there should be alternative methods of raising funds? I know that you were recently part of a field trip that NDVC did, and the folks there have a slightly different approach to helping folks raise capital. But is there an alternative model that you feel like should exist that would work better for this market? I mean, not just mattresses, but DTC in general.
I think there totally should be. We always sort of fell in the middle. So venture capital, they didn't really know how to measure us. So we're this bootstrap business that's profitable. They didn't really get it. You know, some did, but some didn't really get it. So we had a lot of leverage because we didn't need to raise the capital. We weren't like needing to beg for money. We could just keep bootstrapping. So we didn't really resonate with most VCs the way they would typically expect. We're not burning cash and accelerating to a flip or to an IPO in like 3 years. That wasn't really our plan. Our plan was just to build a great business and we would have options in the future. And then the banks and the loans also we weren't set up for either. We have no assets. It's all we have are receivables, but it wasn't necessarily substantial. So and then raising debt, you know, as a growing business, you need to funnel your cash into growth. So, you know, your percentage of income as a part of your net income or net revenue is pretty small. And so raising debt is pretty risky. So I wish there was something hybrid in between. And there are firms that do that, but read those terms, because if you make the wrong step, you'll activate a warrant that'll come to slap you. So we always sort of were frustrated with that. The one debt product that has really helped us was a line of credit. I shouldn't say we've always had one, but I guess technically the Plum was somewhat of a line of credit. But in our third or fourth year, we realized using a line of credit to help our cash flow with inventory would be pretty helpful. But for the most part, we didn't really fit. We were kind of in the middle of two different sides.
When you mentioned that about 25% of mattresses are sold online, a number that comes back often is the one from the Census Bureau that says that about 10% of all retail sales are happening online. From your perspective, I mean, it seems like there's still a ways to go, but how do you assess the health of the e-commerce market as it is today? We've got obviously like Amazon on one side capturing like a huge, like almost half of it. And then we've got, you were the Warby Parker of mattresses, but now it seems like that trend has only accelerated, and there's the Warby Parker, the Tuft and Needle of something happening almost every week. So I'm just curious, like, how do you view the overall health of the space at the moment?
I think the overall across the markets, it's going in the right direction, definitely. The big companies don't really understand, not all of them, some understand it intimately, aren't taking very good leadership and crushing it, but most of them don't. They don't really understand the digital space. And what people need to realize is that the customer journey is incredibly important. So what I mean by that is, if you're going to buy something, you know, what we do now, just think about how you personally shop. I mean, what I do is I just pull up in my phone and I open up Safari and I'll type in what it is I'm looking for, or I'll open up Amazon and type it what it is I'm looking for. You start online and then you decide, okay, here are my options. And then, you know, what I do is I'll go and look at the brand sites and I'll read up on it. And then I'll decide where I'm going to buy it, either from them, or I'll go to Amazon and buy it, or I'll go to a store and see it. It depends on what it is. But the journey is starting digitally. And it's something like 90% or 95% of people start digitally now. And that creates a huge opportunity of white space, because if you've got this old brand that people know and have loved up until this point, but now people start online, they can't seem to find that brand. And they're finding these other ones that are doing a really good job of like showing that they're cool and that they're innovative and that it's easy to get and you can get it right now. That is very enticing value proposition. Also, from a marketing standpoint, if people start online, then you probably want to start advertising to them there. It sort of starts there, or it starts like when you hear about it from a friend, or you see an ad on television, or you know, or hear about it over a podcast. Then you still go online and you search. And if you're not there and you're not part of the conversation or part of the assessment that customers are making, you're really putting yourself at a disadvantage. But a lot of these older established businesses don't realize how important that is. They're accustomed to, you know, spending in a certain amount on marketing and not necessarily seeing what the return on that spend is. They're used to looking at brand awareness, you know, unaided and aided, and brand affinity, and these surveys that I think are can be helpful but are mostly BS. They don't know that there is a way to actually know how many dollars you get back for how many dollars you put out. And you decide on your marketing mix on the fly. It's just not something they're built for, because they're composed of teams of people that don't understand it. They're learning it from like articles they read here and there or going to conferences, but they still don't know how to actually tactically execute it, which is a big problem for the brand. So I think as far as the health, I don't really know how to answer that specifically, but I think that things are going in the right direction as far as new innovation, lots of competition that the customer wins in the end. But the health of the established brands, for the most part, is not good. And that does create a big window of new thinkers and new innovators to go online and go to market. So I think from that standpoint, it's really good, and it's creating a lot of optionality and a lot of iteration and all that.
Yeah, I wonder about, 20 years from now or 30 years from now, what will people's behavior look like? We're training ourselves to do what you're talking about, which is, going online first. But then there's all kinds of categories where, maybe if I'm buying my cereal or something, I go to the cereal aisle and it's more, the CPG world that exists today. Obviously, some people are buying their cereal online, but I guess I wonder if we project ourselves like 20, 30 years in the future, what will the typical patterns of people buying things look like?
Yeah, I think that's a really great question. And I think some countries may be a little bit, like Japan, you see a lot of customer behavior starting there first before it comes to the U.S. And it doesn't always come the same way, but it comes in some other form, and vice versa. It's a really great question and something we should all keep in the back of our minds.
Well, especially because I think that the press is fond of talking about millennials and like how their purchasing habits have shifted, things online more. But millennials actually, for the most part, grew up in a world where they saw the transition from offline to online, whereas our kids are growing up and, some of them are the Gen Z is now, in their teens and pretty soon will be in the workforce, and their world is just having completely grown up in an environment where phones, like mobile phones, are the norm. And I'm just very curious to get to that point because, we grew up in a world where we saw the old way. Some of the kids who are growing up today never saw that.
Yeah, I think it's the path of least resistance. Like, what makes our lives easier? How do we save time? What brings us joy? Gen Zers, I was reading an article that they, they're dating through social media apps. They're not even like dating in person. It's really strange.
I feel like that's happening across all age groups now.
Well, I mean, I've looked over the shoulder at a kid and the messages and all the markups and stuff that they were putting on their photos, sending it to like their girlfriend.
Yeah.
It is definitely different. We might be dating online, but they're doing it in a whole new and advanced way, or you could say non-advanced way, because it's not actually fully connecting with another person, being able to give them a hug. But anyway, yeah, it's definitely changing. And it's always good to think about what is the trigger that enables somebody or motivates somebody to want to get something, your product or service? Like, what happens? And then what's the first thing they do? And you want to be as close to that event as possible. So, or even to predict it. And that's key. And the companies out there who are innovative and want to survive need to be always reinventing themselves and changing and adapting to how the customers are changing, how the new generations are changing, or they're going to just be left behind, which this is very relevant to the merger that we made with Serta Simmons. This is it's a great question. Something that entrepreneurs should be thinking about nonstop, especially when they're thinking about starting a new business.
I want to talk about Serta in a second, but you mentioned something before about investors not necessarily understanding that, businesses in the e-commerce space sometimes cap out sooner than they expect. Is that something that you found with Tuft & Needle? Were there points in time where you saw the business start to plateau and that pushed you to do something different that you hadn't planned for? Or how did you think about those moments when maybe at a certain point it felt like, hey, we've sold all the mattresses we can to the people who want to buy them, through this particular channel?
Yeah, and that's just the thing. I'm familiar with other D2C companies, either through friends or advising or something like that. And I see this happening in other markets as well. We thought we were going to grow faster online in the later years because we thought that the percentage of people buying online would be larger. There was no good market data, that could really factually say how many people are buying online. It was a big question mark that a lot of people want to know. And also, like, how many people buy on Amazon? Because that's another big aspect of it. And, what platforms do they buy on? But, I mean, obviously, Google and Amazon are the biggest. So we thought it would be bigger. So as we started to see year-over-year growth declining, we're still growing fast. It's just not quite as fast. I mean, it's not like 10x every year, it's like 10x and then it's like 8x and then 6 and then four and then two, you start to wonder, all right, are we capping out or is it a competitor absorbing it? And we started to realize that the market must not be as big as we thought. And so we started to get ahead of it and think about, well, what will be next? And so we thought, well, where else do people want to buy a mattress? So there's mattress stores where we're thinking to ourselves, we don't like the experience there. That might not be good for our brand until they fix themselves. So we're thinking, well, what about clubs like your Costco's and Lowe's? Or what about like your big boxes, like your Targets and your Walmarts? And, you know, we had other ideas like DIY, which we were the first company to do that for mattresses. You know, where could we put our product where people would want to buy a mattress? And so we saw that as how we go and capture the other 80% or capture and go after the bigger companies. But the problem is it's a chicken and egg issue. When you go to these big companies, they're like, who are you? Like, no, we don't know who you are. You're not big enough. We're not going to, you know, not consider you. But you can't get big enough until one of them takes you, sort of a deal. That's where Amazon helps. but anyway, so that it was a little bit of a chicken and egg problem. So we also thought, okay, so if we can't easily distribute or convince them or strike the terms that make sense with our business model, then let's open up our own stores. So we started doing that. And then eventually we grew big enough that the bigger companies started to reach out to us. And then we were able to strike deals that were good for our business, but also good for the customers.
Did you ever have trouble with, because I think so much of the direct-to-consumer, the Warby Parker of X kind of phenomenon partially was about cutting out the middleman and having a better price point because of that. Was that something that you found difficult to reconcile when you started to bring it to other stores?
Oh, definitely. So I could tell you the first couple of years, it was almost impossible to be able to afford it unless we raised our prices, which was an option for us. But we wanted to keep our prices as low as we could for our customers. We have a saying internally that we charge what we need, not what we can. And that's how we determine our pricing, what we need to pay our employees well and competitively, but also to have enough money left over to be able to fund growth and innovation. Yeah, early on, it wouldn't have made that much sense unless it was a big platform company. Otherwise, you know, we'd have to raise prices. So, but what happened is we grew, we gained economy of scale. So we were able to negotiate better rates with our factories and our components and gain more efficiency through automation. So what people don't realize is under the hood, our company operates like a software business, and all our process, we built our own software, so it's very automated. We haven't hired an additional customer experience team member in over 2 years. We froze that team's headcount despite all the growth that we've had over the last 2 years and challenged the design and engineering team to automate their process. Because that was the breaking point where we saw it was worth the time and the energy for the engineers and designers to do it. So we've through automation and gaining leverage with the team overhead, and then also with the economy of scale and lowering prices and negotiating better rates with our manufacturers, we gained more margin. And that extra margin we were able to share with distributors like Amazon as an example. So so we were able to, at the price points we had, we were able to sustain those kind of cuts for distributors without having to raise our prices specifically for that.
But do you feel like from a customer-facing communication, it posed any challenges because like people had kind of set up that mindset? Or was it now that they were seeing it in stores, it felt fine to see it there?
You know, I stressed a lot about that. We had an opportunity with Costco early on, and we declined it. We were like, this isn't good enough for our brand. And now my perspective is completely different. So I think it's great. So one thing to think about is all of the great brands that you know, one of the things about them is they're in all these different places. So that's part of the definition of your brand. If you're in these places, that's how you become a household name brand. Another is, you know, we instead of just saying, no, we're not doing it, we listed out what is the criteria, what are the guiding principles to making a decision like this. So here's an example. We started measuring Net Promoter Score, which is a way of measuring customer satisfaction since the beginning. And it's part of our feedback loop we use to iterate on product and service and policies and pricing and all that. So if we were going to partner with a distributor, what kind of NPS do they have for their customers? Mm-hmm. We wanted to partner with companies that were loved or valued not a company that was hated and didn't take care of its customers, because we don't want that negative halo around our brand. So when we think about Amazon, Amazon has a high NPS. They take very good care of their customers. They're respected. And so we felt that that wasn't, our NPS is about the same, a little bit higher right now anyway. We felt that it was a net neutral. So it wasn't good. It wasn't bad. It was, but hey, we're more available. So that, from that aspect, that was really good, because there are people that would just want to buy an Amazon, and there are people that want to just buy direct from the brand, and there's people that kind of do both. I personally do both. So it actually makes our brand more convenient. So it makes the value proposition better. But we would just want to make sure, if we're going to be in other channels, that it's not going to be put a negative halo around us. A big one was Walmart. We're thinking, oh, Walmart, like junky store. That's not true, but it has this negative halo around it with certain people. I mean, Walmart sells Dyson. I mean, Dyson's a great brand. It sells a lot of badass brands. It doesn't mean that this, you know, the store is bad, or that those brands are bad by being there. There are a lot of people that love Walmart and shop there, and it's convenient for them. So that was our perspective in choosing Walmart. I remember when we opened up a store, it was in Scottsdale. We opened up a physical store, standalone. It's its own building. And there was an empty lot next to it. And on the other side of the empty lot was McDonald's. And I originally thought, oh, McDonald's, like, this isn't going to be good for the brand. Like, you know, and I named a couple of other brands that would never do that. We put it there, and it had zero effect. Nobody thinks that way. I was just over inflate. I was making a mountain out of an anthill. It's like overthinking it.
I find that that happens a lot, and it's not just you. And I mean, maybe the founders are even more so, like, maybe the harshest critics, but sometimes there's that kind of notion that is circulating around your team or your company. How do you kind of get in more of an experimental mindset, or what did it take to convince the other folks on your team, like, hey, let's try it out?
Yeah, exactly what you said, experimental mindset. So we thought, okay, well, let's do it and see what happens. And if it doesn't go well, we won't do that again. We can always pull our product out of a distributor. If our customers are pissed, then we can pull it out. We literally had nobody send us an email and say, oh, you're in Walmart, like, forget you guys, you're not good anymore. Nope, never happened. It only made people happier, because we're there, the people that go there. And the people that don't like Walmart, they don't go to Walmart, so it doesn't matter to them. But there's also another aspect of, well, which product do you put in Walmart? So we put the product that we feel resonates with the Walmart customer. We're also in Crate and Barrel. And Crate and Barrel has, you know, they have different standards, a different aesthetic, a different quality than maybe what you find generally or in certain parts of Walmart. We put a different product there, and it resonates with those customers. So I actually do value dogmas, and I value hard stances. I think that some of those perspectives can bring uniqueness to your brand and differentiation, because if you try to cater to everything and serve everyone and be all things all people, you're just going to end up with mediocrity and generalism, and you're just going to just fade away. But at the same time, you need to have some self-awareness and say, maybe we're overthinking this. Let's just try it and see. Because if the size of the prize might be worth it, let's just see what happens. And if it doesn't go well, we'll pull it out and we'll apologize.
One thing that seems like an obvious limitation or challenge around your business is that people buy a mattress maybe, you know, once every 10 years or something like that. How did you figure out how to solve that challenge, or broaden what Tuft & Needle was to people, since, you know, having recurring business, if someone does have a positive experience, yeah, they can refer a friend, but being able to, like, be a part of their life in a deeper way seems like a really good thing for most businesses.
Yeah, I'm not a huge fan of planned obsolescence. I'm very much against it. You know, I'm a frequent reader of Buy It for Life on Reddit, and I care a lot about everything that I personally buy. I want stuff to last. So maybe that makes me a bad businessman, but I do care a lot about product and design. So as far as, like, wanting customers to buy more frequently, which companies usually try to do, I'm not necessarily a fan of that unless it solves a pain point for customers. It's about every 8 years. What we see, it's about every 3 years with our brand, because when people move is a key moment for them to buy a mattress. And hey, they can get the new model and they can call up Tuft & Needle and we'll come pick it up and donate it. So it's, for us, it's a little bit more frequent, which is beneficial, but we have other products. So one of the things you'll realize with a lot of these other brands, big brands, is they don't have accessories, or they do. I don't call them accessories because they're just private labeling the same things that other brands are selling. We actually design our products. With every product we design, we take the same approach, iterative approach. We make a hate list. We go shopping. The product team goes shopping, and they build their hate list, and then they put together their MVP, their thesis. They build prototypes. They test it internally. They test it externally. And then when we're ready, we'll either test it in the store or part online, or we'll just do a full rollout. And then we iterate on feedback. Every product should be able to be its own business on its own is sort of how we approach it.
So I'm going to skip ahead a little bit, but amazingly, bootstrapping from where you were in 2012 and through many of the strategies that we've been talking about, you grew the company to, I'm not sure what the latest public figures are, but hundreds of millions of dollars in revenue. And 8-9 months ago, you announced the merger. So why? Why did you decide to do that, especially since you kind of set out to disrupt this industry?
Yeah, so we bootstrapped all the way. So that $6,000 turned and was a very big return. what happened was we were also of these emerging brands, the first to open up a permanent store and kind of figure out the business model. We figured out how to turn our stores profitable, and we've also figured out how to do out-of-home marketing profitably. But there's one catch. It takes some time to get the return on that investment. And investment isn't, you know, if you're thin on cash, isn't something you can really do unless you want to go raise capital or take on some debt. Neither of which we were really considering. But then once we saw the return and we were confident that we can really scale this up at the retail stores, we started to raise capital. And it was a very small amount. It was $25 million that we were raising. And that was the exact amount of money we needed to scale to a certain rate of speed for stores, because we wanted to open up a couple hundred stores. Word got out, and then our competitors reacted, and then they started to accelerate it. Whether they figured it out or not, I don't know. But during this exercise, we've done this a few times, like I had mentioned, but this is we now know exactly what we're going to use the money for. Word got out that, oh, Tough Needle's raising money now. So we got that influx again from venture capital, but now from private equity. And so we took the stance like, let's just talk to all the different options, the private equity and venture capital. Let's meet them, see if we like them. If they like us, if we're a good fit. What kind of terms could we get? The word got out even to strategics, so like factories and competitors and all of that. And at the end, we ended up with a lot of really interesting options. So we actually did not choose the most lucrative option, which would have been like an all-cash buyout. But we chose the one that we felt was the best for the brand and the team and for our original mission. Our original mission was to disrupt this industry and change it forever. And you do that by changing the industry to being customer-centric because it wasn't prioritizing people. And we knew that one way to do that is to become the leader, to become the number one, or at least to challenge the leader as the number 2, 3, 4, or 5 and provoke them to updating their way of behaving so that the majority of consumers have these options to choose to go down the path of a company that takes care of them. So we were projecting that in 5 years from the time that we raised money, we would cross $1 billion in revenue. How accurate that was, we were confident in it. It wasn't a high or a low, it was like medium, like realistic, it's possible. A lot of things have to go right, but we felt that it was very possible. So as we were meeting and greeting and pitching these different types of investors, we then started to meet strategics. I mean, even like from other countries, it was a really wild ride. It took about a year from the time that we started to raise the $25 million to the time that we had several options in front of us to decide. And it was everyone from big platforms that you know and big box to factory. We had an option from a factory, competitors. We had private equity, no VC. And it just wasn't a good fit for our path. And so Serta Simmons, we sort of scoffed at it at first because this is one of the key companies we're disrupting. And we decided just to entertain the idea, just to see. And we were at an industry conference in Vegas, and we met with Advent, the company that owns Serta Simmons. And to be perfectly honest, after 15 minutes, I completely changed my mind because they were saying all the right things. What they saw for the future for Certa-Simmons was to be customer-centric, and that's the only way that they saw that the company would survive and continue to be a leader and to serve customers. And so all the things they were describing was what we already were. And then that led to a meeting with the CEO, Michael Traub, and I found out, I didn't know this, that he's not from the industry. He came from Bosch in Germany. And I'm actually a fan of Bosch. I mean, I have one of their appliances and specifically picked that one. And other executives we met were not from the industry either. And the interesting thing about this was SSB wants to be like Tough the Needle, and Tough the Needle wants to be the size of SSB. So the question is, if we were to merge the companies, which is the only way we would have done this deal, it would theoretically accelerate us to our goal in 5 years almost instantly, but we'd have to transform SSB because we're only, you know, we were a smaller percentage of their revenue after post-merger. So that was the question. If we could convert them to be like Tough the Needle, then we would have accomplished our mission. So it's like the disruptor, the original disruptor and the largest mattress company, the disruptor goes inside to disrupt the biggest company and then transforms them. So it's kind of like Neo when he jumps into Mr. Smith or whatever his name is in the movie. And so part of the deal was also control. So Dahi and I are very large shareholders of the business and have executive roles and are very active on the board. And we're given very serious responsibility to helping to fix the business. And that was also gave us confidence that, okay, we were given this much control. We're giving up a lot of control, but then we're also given a lot of control within their business, and we believed it. So we were very cautiously optimistic about it. So the theory is if we were to transform them, then as the leading company, we're done. And because the thing is, think about Apple. When Apple changes its form factor or introduces a feature, what happens? All of its key competitors answer it. Or its key competitors are always trying to best Apple. And the same thing with Samsung and vice versa. And so if SSB releases a 100-day free trial, what do you think Tempur-Pedic has to do now? And that's the thing, is that you see this trickle of this domino effect, and that's what leaders do. And so here you've got the leader and the disruptor, and if we could cause mass scale disruption and transformation of the whole industry, we would have completed our mission. I want to basically check the mission off as done and create a new mission. I want the challenge of like, okay, now what do we do? I want that to happen. So that was the reason we did this merger. It obviously put a lot at risk because you have two very different types of teams, two very different types of cultures. Tough the Needle won the top company culture in Entrepreneur Magazine in 2017. You know, this culture is a very rich, very unique culture here, and it does put that at risk. It's going to change. And the question is, like, is this going to be good for the employees? Is it going to be good for our customers? And we decided that this was the best path to causing the lasting change that we had originally set out to solve. So anyway, that's the primary reasoning behind it.
So, but you're talking about the Tough to Needle employees, but to some extent, if you're like going inside Agent Smith and like destroying him, isn't this that maybe dangerous for the people who work at Certa-Simmons? Or were they, to some extent, I'm sure a lot of them were seeing what was happening in the market and asking themselves, like, how can we be more like Tough to Needle? And so there's a desire to shift towards that behavior. But at the same time, if you're coming in and, you know, ripping out pieces that are not working, doesn't that cause a lot of structural change that feels uncomfortable to the people who've been there for a while?
Yep, it does. And actually, I think from the story from The Matrix, I think Neo kind of became part of Smith or something.
It's I don't know if the analogy holds up or not.
No, I actually just realized that this is actually a great analogy. I've never thought of it, but no, that's so he didn't completely destroy him. So yeah, that's what's happening, and it's actually already happened. So and it's continuing to. So yeah, there have been major team cuts in Atlanta where SSB is located. There's been a lot of changes. So the company is being disrupted. It is recognized and it is taking action. It's sad because, you know, people need to move on, but the fact of the matter is if the company doesn't transform, it's not going to be relevant in the future. So it has to change. So it already has begun. Tough the Needle is now Team Phoenix, and we've taken over a lot of the responsibilities. And there's been some redundancy cuts, not in Phoenix. We have not recognized any of that here It's possible, but I really doubt it, that it'll happen or in any significant way that would disrupt the team. Culture is very highly valued by Advent. Advent has a very good reputation for being good stewards of brand and being very successful to making brands better, which was one of the key aspects of this decision. So they are guarding Tuft & Needle. In some aspects, we are a walled garden. In other aspects, we are merging. So as time goes on, the goal is to fully integrate the teams together and have it lean and mean and being very customer-centric, offering better products to the retailers and having our own stores and direct-to-consumer and all that stuff. So yeah, you're right. And there's already been changes, and there's going to be a lot more if we're successful.
Your title now is Chief Strategy Officer, but what is your job? What are you doing now that you're at Serta officially?
So primarily it's to sort of solve the puzzles. So not only figuring out how do you transform the business, given you have all these retailers and there's different aspects of leverage on both sides, and not upsetting them, but how do you consolidate 10,000 models to something simpler? How do you? But it's also educational. So right now, my current job is to define the strategy that transforms the business for the future, be able to articulate it and build a plan, and then carry it out.
How do you make the difference when you're going in and rethinking these processes between the knowledge that's been built up at the company at Serta over the course of decades that, you know, is valuable versus the stuff that you have innovated on and invented at Tuft & Needle? Is it one of those situations where you have to cut more aggressively because you want to make sure that that stuff doesn't grow back? Like, I don't know if that makes sense, but basically, how do you know what to keep and what to give up?
Well, first off, there's timing and what the timing is of the business and when it needs to transform. So the market, and this is like in any market, you know, there's different places where the revenue comes from. So I had mentioned it's like 20% is online and 80% is offline. But then offline, there's like a percentage that's big box and percentage that's the clubs and the percentage that's retailers. And what we're seeing is that the market, the channel mix is changing, and it's being, one is cannibalizing the other. And it's like going back to where the customer journey is and how it's changing. What I always do is I go back to, what does the future state look like? So you define that really clearly. So what do we want it to, what do we think it will look like? What do we think the market mix will look like in the future? And then we work backwards from there to see what is the next step we take. Some of these need to be slow and some of them need to be fast. Like making team changes, probably fast. Changing how we work with distributors or partners, probably slow. Accelerating Tuft & Needle, probably fast. But what we always do is, or what I have been really doing a lot of, is just projecting into the future. And what you do is you look at comps. So you can say, what is a market that's similar? Maybe one, a market that's not similar, but we can pull inspiration from. So we can do this. I can tell you that who are two big contributors to the disruption of the mattress industry? I would say Amazon and Apple. Amazon is training people to get products right now, get it in 2 days. It's eventually going to be same day across the nation. Eventually it's going to be in 15 minutes, right? So if that's the case, then you would expect that mattresses probably would also be similar. If the people buying our mattresses are getting all their products right now, then we probably need to get their mattress to them right now or as soon as we can. If Apple has a certain amount of innovation or a certain amount of aesthetic and design or customer flow and experience, people expect that. Or to walk into a store and be able to find all these cool toys to play with and people that can answer all of your questions and you can see all the products and get your hands on it. People are being trained by these great leaders in these different industries. It's not just tech. You can see all these great examples because these are the companies conditioning customers to expect a certain type of service or a certain type of product. And so you can use those as signals or measures or clues as to what the future would be like. So if you say, in 3 years, this is what the mattress company will look like that'll win. Sort of back to the hate list and that antithesis to the hates. It's all those fixes. What are the key attributes? And then selecting those and saying, okay, this is the one that we need. These are the three we need to work on right now. It's like kind of going down each of these aspects, like customer service. What kind of service do they have? So it's like I said, back with Tough to Needle, it's not like a silver bullet. It's like all of the things. It's like a sum of it all. And just starting, you know, you just have to get traction. And with a merger, I can tell you, you want to get traction on something quick. And so we've shown some aspect of that, but we've got something big coming soon that will not only be a signal to the world, and we go back to our customers and tell them, this is why we did it. We told you why, but now we're showing you. But even to our own employees, because you want people to know, like, this was the best thing for them, the best thing for the customer. So that's a long-winded answer, but it's very complicated, and my job is a very complicated job.
Every answer you give, I have 10 more questions to ask. We'll have to have you for a part two. I want to end on one topic. You mentioned it sort of with this idea of, like, you want to get to the point where you can check off, like, mission accomplished. To some extent, it feels like you got at least one check mark, which is, like, change the way people perceive mattresses and, you know, move them towards this new model, or at least help people understand that that's possible. And I feel like this merger kind of proves that you kind of checked off that particular mission. Now there's this, like, next level of that mission, which is, can we convince the rest of the world, the other, you know, 75%, that that's the right idea? If you can check that box off, do you already know what the next mission is? Have you thought about that?
I think it'll be around innovation and product, because right now, if you say, like, you know, our company needs to innovate, it needs to disrupt, like, big companies always say that innovation is like a core value or whatever. Right now, the big companies' innovation is really shouldn't necessarily be designing a new kind of foam or a new kind of material or a new kind of whatever. I think it should be just serving the customer they want to be served, right? That's the current problem. When that problem is accomplished and that's checked off, I think it's going to go back to products or new innovative ways to serve them. Like, is it a mattress that ships in a shoebox, or is it a new kind of material that makes the mattress much lighter? Or is it something that's, like, you know, every mattress is custom designed for each person? I don't know, but I think that it would likely, step one is within our world, is to make the whole company SSB like more like Tough to Needle and one that customers love. And, you know, checking off that, okay, the customer problem has been fixed in the industry. Now all the other companies are replicating it. Okay, so now it is, how do we make even better product? How do we service the customers better? Like, very likely it's going to integrate technology and environment and making people more comfortable and sleeping better. I mean, it all goes back to sleep. But for the most part right now, I think people sleep, on at least on our products, very well. That's not the big problem to solve. It's really taking care of them. And then I think we get back to sleep and figure out how to serve the customers that are very happy even better.
Have you heard this quote from Reed Hastings, the CEO of Netflix, that he thinks sleep is the biggest competitor to Netflix? And if so, what do you say to that?
Oh, I completely agree.
Netflix is the biggest competitor for you?
Yeah, I mean, well, I would say people use our product more than Netflix. Maybe Netflix is our biggest competitor.
Yeah, I mean, the product, I joke about this with Lumi and packaging, which is, like, if somehow we get disrupted by, like, a teleportation machine that makes packaging completely irrelevant, I think that'll be a win for society. I don't know if I agree necessarily. I personally love to sleep, but your competition could be like a pill that makes people not have to sleep anymore or something like that.
Totally. It's a great idea.
Well, I don't know if it is or not. I'm sure it would have its own downsides and side effects, but we'll see if it happens. Anyway, I'm stopping myself because I feel like I have to, just because it's getting late and I want to be respectful of your time. People can find out more about you and about the company, obviously tn.com. If they go visit, that is your website. What else do you want to point people to?
tn.com. Yeah, that's our site. And yeah, I really appreciate this interview. It was a lot of fun.
Thank you so much. It was great to meet you. So thoughtful. And we'll have to do a part two someday.
Sounds good. Thank you.
Ooh, one last thing before we go. I'm talking to you at home. What's your favorite brand these days? Is there something that you think is really well made? Or maybe someone that you'd love for me to talk to? Send us a tweet. We are at Lumi, L-U-M-I, on Twitter. We're making this show for you, so tell us what you want to hear, and we'll make it happen. Thanks. See you next time.